ready for the most merry mission of the year, Blitzen? What the...
Sprinkles, get down!
Although edited for television, tonight's thriller contains scenes of suspense and violence which may be unsuitable for young viewers. Parental discretion is advised.
So I saw Predator on a pirate video, could barely make out what was going on. I saw Rambo in the same format.
The UK strikes about, again?
Exactly. Something about jungle and pirate videos in my house, apparently. But yeah, no, Predator I loved. My first comic Predator was the Batman Predator crossover, which was also early days of me getting into US format comics as well. So I have a real soft spot for Predator as a concept. Though, as I've read comics over time, the comics are clearly, I think even more so than Aliens, are just retreading the same ground over and over and over again, which isn't a bad thing. The early Predator miniseries are great. There's a few good ones along the way. The Dean Ormston one set in the Civil War is pretty fantastic. Name of which will come to me. Hell Come a Walking, that's it. And I really love the Predator, I think it's Predators, the one with Adrian Brody. That's Predators,
yes, that's
right?
Correct. Yes, again, the same convention as Aliens. They just pluralized it.
Yeah. So a friend of mine told me, and I don't think I've heard this come up in your previous Predator conversation, but basically, the character that Lawrence Fishburne was supposed to play, or played rather, was originally supposed to be Dutch. It was basically written for Schwarzenegger, and he decided against it in the end. So if you watch that film, conscious that Lawrence Fishburne is basically Arnold Schwarzenegger in the first Predator movie coming back to it, it really changes your appreciation of that film. I really like that film. I know a lot of people don't, but I think that Rodriguez, right? I really like Robert Rodriguez.
Well, no, you know what? I don't think he actually directed it, though. I think he just produced it.
He produced it, that's right. And it's directed by somebody who did some other interesting stuff. I've got like an encyclopedic knowledge of film stuff up to a point, and then I know nothing anymore.
Well, and I do appreciate that context, because I did enjoy that movie, but I think probably the Lawrence Fishburne element was my least favorite part of that movie. Yeah. Knowing that's supposed to be Dutch, it makes me want to rewatch it again. I'm obviously going to wait until it comes up in the podcast cycle,
yeah.
And I got a little ways to go before that happens, but I'm going to keep that in mind, because that's going to be interesting. That's going to definitely give me something up to latch on to.
Yeah, it really colors your perspective, because they clearly went, okay, we can't get Schwarzenegger. What about the badass from The Matrix or whatever, you know? I think there's also probably, I don't know, a little bit of Apocalypse Now hangover, you know, Lawrence Fishburne in the jungle, even if it's about 40, 50 years removed.
Predator Bad Blood began as a three-part serial running in Dark Horse Comics' series Dark Horse Comics, number 12 through 14, cover dated August through November of 1993. It was written by Evan Dorkin, who's one of my favorite satirists in comics. I've got several hardcovers of his works on my shelves. I love his comedic work. He has also worked on television. He was involved with Space Ghost Coast to Coast, for instance, and I met him in person. I've gotten art from him. Great guy. Love talking with him. I've never been as drawn to his serious work as to his comedic work, but I was looking forward to this story. Art's by Derek Thompson. Thompson had previously done a Predator cover for one of the issues of Dark Horse Comics. This new stuff is out there. Very expressive, very dark and gory and violent. Good fit for the Predators. I'm sorry he didn't do an alien story or do more alien stories. He's apparently from Atlanta. He was still in art college when he got the assignment to work on Bad Blood. He did a little bit more comic books work, but he transitioned pretty quickly to storyboards and conceptual artwork. He worked at Industrial Light and Magic. He worked at Skywalker Ranch. He was involved in the productions of Men in Black 2, the re-release of Return of the Jedi, Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. He went on to doing animation and video game work. He worked on X-Men Evolution. Suffice to say, guy was a catch. Synopsis for the first chapter reads, "Predators are a lot of things. Mean, nasty, and cruel, to name a few. There are things that make even the meanest predators twitch, and one of them comes to Earth in part one of Evan Dorkin's new Predator Bad Blood, premiering in this issue of Dark Horse Comics." So the first issue features a Derek Thompson painted cover of Predator on Predator Violence, and we open with a shot of a ripped up Predator ship. Looks more like something, was it the Reavers or the Ravagers, the crazed cannibals from Serenity? It looks like one of their ships where it's just like spitting out all kinds of carbon, and bits of it are flying off as it flies past the moon, past the point where an American flag is waving. toward the Earth, and they start closing in on the ship, and it reminds me a lot of the late Kevin O'Neill. It reminds me of the less well-known Anthony Williams, and also frequent Garth Ennis collaborator John McCrae. If you really want to visualize this without actually looking at the pages, I would say that if you had John McCrae aping the style of Kevin O'Neill, that's what this would look like. And so all this is happening over narration from radio, where basically you have somebody talking about serial killers and how they present and all this kind of stuff, and it's informing you that this predator isn't a normal predator. This is a batshit crazy predator who's killed his own, has done things to the bodies that line his ship, and we're seeing him being actively pursued by more proper predators, a slew of them. It looks like five, and they're flying around in something that looks like something more like a Klingon ship. Meanwhile, of all the places to cut to, we're going to a paintball course in the woods of rural New Jersey, I guess. And we don't necessarily know what's going on, but one of the guys is the acting manager, but he seems to be distracted. He's trying to do stuff. There's another guy who's more of a redneck, Harley Davidson, Ford Tough kind of right-winger type. He even wears a red cap before is the end thing to do in that crowd. Solicitation copy from Dark Horse Comics number 13 reads, okay, what are the odds here? A small group of Colonial Marines deep underground with no usable transport and minimal firepower. 40 bazillion ill-tempered aliens. Could be bad. Find out for sure in part two of Aliens Backsplash. It's just a paintball game, right? Nothing to cry over. In Predator Bad Blood Part 2, Chris, who's the acting manager guy, discovers that not all the players are obnoxious city slickers, nor are they all human. Also in this issue, there's nothing wrong with a little bit of research, unless your research involves the deadliest organism on Earth. Catch The Thing from Another World, Questionable Research, part one of a new four-part Thing series. Forget the skies, watch your back. $2.50, monthly shipping September 28th, 1993. The Predator crash land, the crazy Predator crash lands near Body Count paintball games, and it just so happens that's the day when they've got a bunch of lawyers who have paid a small fortune to take over the place. One of them even has a Gatling gun, paint gun, which should be illegal but isn't, but it definitely makes him a schmuck among schmucks. None of the guys who work at Body Count are happy about dealing with these guys. They're all threatening that if they're not satisfied, they're gonna sue somebody. They're just a bunch of jerks. And so one of the guys that's keeping an eye on them, he gets shot by the Gatling gun and threatens to throw out the balding lawyer that's running around with the thing. The lawyer claims that it was an accident. The guy ends up letting it go. And anyway, while they were distracted dealing with that situation, another sniper paintball guy manages to nail the Gatling gun guy, who's refusing to quit even though he's clearly been tagged. It's made moot pretty quickly because then the crazy predator starts painting his own blood all over the campsite. And so the acting manager guy, who's been busy back at the office, he starts hearing all kinds of panicked communications. He brings his dogs to try to see what the hell's going on. He finds this horrible massacre scene, and the Gatling gun guy is getting his back broken by some invisible force. As his last act, he manages to let loose with the Gatling gun and spray paint the invisible predator red. That's going to be handy because it's going to help to differentiate him from the other predators once they show up. Solicitation copy from Dark Horse Comics number 14. Dark Horse Comics number 14 premieres part one of The Mark, Taking Back the Streets, a sharp-edged tale of a country torn by revolution. Luzzani's current leader, the Archon, leaves for the United States. But will he be able to return, or will he become Luzzani's newest political exile? Also this month, in the final installment of Predator Bad Blood, the Predator decides it's time to really go to town, with a vengeance. Although laboratories are supposed to be safe, clean, and efficient, when tempers flare, accidents can happen. In part two of The Thing from Another World, Questionable Research, when accidents happen, things get very much out of control. Shipping October 26th, 1993. So in this installment, the dogs save the Chris guy temporarily. You're hearing them ooing for a bit and then start yiping and then they die. And meanwhile, the Chris guy manages to get to his motorcycle because he's freaked out and rushing. It's not wanting to turn over. But just as the crazy predator is laying hands on him, it finally revs up and he starts flying off. But he's looking back at the predator instead of not in front of him, and he smashes into the sign for no parking. It messes up his bike. He struggles again. The bike is not able to go at full speed to the point where the predator is actually starting to catch up on it and swipe at the guy. Again, he's distracted. He runs right into an oncoming pickup truck. The guys get out of the truck. They're a little freaked out about maiming this poor dude. Doesn't really matter because the predator grabs them by the insides of their mouths and rips their heads off from the mouth line upward. And then he takes Chris's heads besides. And then for this last section, it's another instance of Dworkin writing a bunch of inane radio blather. Intentional. It's not like he was writing it inane because of his own efforts, but because that's just what it is. You know, it's blather from the radio, but it matches up with a bunch of stuff in the story. It's fun. I'm really digging the vibe of this story at this point. So cover dates would make you think that the strip ended and we went immediately into the Bad Blood miniseries, because it's got a December 1993 cover date. It runs until June 1994. 1994 by Coverdate. However, there was a gap in the Dark Horse Insiders that tipped me off, and I went and checked at Mike's Amazing World of Comics, and there was, in fact, a month gap between the two books. Number 14 of Dark Horse Comics shipped October 26, 1993, and Bad Blood number 1 shipped on December 28, 1993, so there was a two-month gap. Also worth noting is December 1993 through June 1994 is not 4 months, but there's supposed to be a four-month issue miniseries. So the first three issues, according to Mike, ship monthly, but then there's a huge gap between the third and the fourth issues. Number 3 is supposed to have shipped on February 22nd, 94, and then number 4, June 28th. So that was a four-month wait for the fourth issue. But again, with the detailing on this comic, and given that it's a just graduated or graduating art student, I'm not entirely surprised that there might have been some issues getting that last issue together. Solicitation copy reads, "The New Jersey Pine Barrens have become a slaughterhouse, witness to a hideous spree of murders and mutilations. Ex-CIA operative John Pulnick is accused of the gruesome crimes, but he knows the true identity of the slayer, a creature from another world, a predator. And like others of his species, the alien intruder is no sport hunter, but a blood-crazed psychotic, a butcher of its own kind, an unhinged killing machine. While a massive manhunt sweeps the barrens, a stalker of a different kind searches for the killer, a second predator, bent on bringing down the rogue monster." And so the actual miniseries picks up where we left off, which I thought was going to be a bit weird because so much of this has been related to the paintball thing, and we're bringing in another guy after all these people have already been slaughtered. And so this dude is the owner of the paintball place, and he has the unfortunate nickname of Papa John, which will come up over and over again. People actually often will just call him Papa. It's, I don't know where it came from. It was very off-putting for me the entire story. So he's in traffic in Jersey, and some people are riding his ass or something, and so he gets pissed off, and he jumps out, and he with an automatic weapon, and starts, you know, firing onto their hood and their windshield. Red splotches everywhere, but of course it's a paint gun. And the guy's talking about how 3 years earlier he'd have been firing real bullets. And then we're continuing to have the radio chatter, the broadcast radio. Dworkin's good at writing this material. It's pretty much dead on, but it also informs the story. I like that element. Again, after the three-issue serial and then going into this miniseries, I really thought that this was going to be my favorite book of all the titles we were going to cover in this omnibus. So Papa John gets the body count. There's already cops everywhere, and he's trying to get in to see what happened to his people, and he's being kind of forceful about it, but he keeps getting put off. Then choppers arrive, and they're coming in from Langley, and it's Claude Loudermilk who's going to be the antagonist of this story. Loudermilk immediately recognizes Papa John and orders his arrest. This guy needs to be retained for questioning, blah blah blah. Papa John fights his way out through the barricades, gets into the forest, finds all the bodies of all these people that had rented his space and had worked for him. In a really weird bit of business, there's sort of a bone sword thing that's been shoved into somebody, and so Papa goes to try to pull this thing out, which, like, you know, people have already tried to detain you for questioning. You probably don't want to be putting your hands all over a murder weapon. But as he does that, red drips onto him. I think it's still supposed to be some loose red paint, or because I don't think the predator has been wounded. But the predator comes down on him, and he's got like severed heads dangling from his belt. And one thing that's nice is, yeah, you've got the red paint to differentiate this guy from the other predators to come. But also, this one's got piercings, and it's drawn in just this exaggerated way. It's got these big alien, not xenomorph alien, but extraterrestrial demonic knee pad things, and it's drawn in just such an exaggerated manner that you don't need somebody to tell you that this is the crazy predator. You know, he's got the nipple piercings, he's got this manner about how he's walking and stuff, a little bit more like an ape, and he's just different from the rest of them. You can tell, and it's to the credit of the artist that you don't need a bunch of information to know this guy's nuts job. And anyway, the Papa John, people are continuing to pursue him, and so those people get wiped the hell out. And then at one point Papa John gets back to his truck, and he pulls his Uzi on Loudermilk, and even though everybody knows the paint gun, they're such pussies that they won't stand up to him for it and let him drive off, at least temporarily. Now, one bit that doesn't work for me is the pursuing predator arrives, and again, they've done a really good job of differentiating, because this character has a bunch of silver armor on, and it has a weird helmet that's different from all the other predators, where it's like almost like a sunburst, where there's multiple points coming off of it, and you can just tell that this is a different predator than the other one, and also from other predators, because all that silver is just not common. Solicitation copy from issue number 2. A special task force sweeps the New Jersey Pine Barrens in search of a psychotic predator, a blood-crazed butcher bent on killing any living creature it encounters. While the government craves the beast technology, a team of ex-CIA rogue agents have different plans for the extraterrestrial monster and its human hunters. And if this cast of spooks and psychos weren't enough of a potential powder keg, enter another predator, here to wreak vengeance upon its unhinged brother and anything that gets in its way. So yeah, so you've got this other predator, but we saw in the serial that they were like, like 5 or 6 predators coming, and yet the only one that comes out is this one dude. It's like, well, where's the other guys? You're hunting a crazy serial killer that's got like all these bodies and stuff everywhere. Shouldn't you have a whole team on this shit? So I don't know if it was a situation where the artist just drew something he wasn't supposed to draw, but they completely fucking forget about that shit for most of the rest of the story. So anyway, Papa goes and visits a local sheriff that he's buddies with, but the guy's still freaked out because they've put on the ATV that he's the serial killer and everybody's hunting after him, and the deputy guy doesn't know if he's, you know, what to do. And then the CIA shows up and clubs the guy in the back of the head and brings him in. And then the Loudermilk's people are taking over the whole town, and the deputy guy's like, yeah, I think I fucked up. I should have believed my buddy because they're feeding me a bunch of bullshit. Before Papa got caught, he had given a strand of dreadlock predator hair and a phone number to the deputy guy, and so he ends up calling the number. And what we find out over this is that Papa is ex-CIA, black ops kind of guy, that he had a whole group of people that he'd worked with. He had retired, but his other buddies had gone MIA, they'd gone AWOL. Loudermilk was apparently had brought in the Chris guy, the acting manager of the paintball place, to infiltrate the operation to monitor Papa, waiting to see if he was ever going to contact these other CIA buddies. And that's the whole reason why they allowed him to retire. He doesn't like any of these guys. He wants to take care of all these guys, but he was trying to use Papa to get to the other people. But see, the deputy buddy has called those other people in. They're way better at this than Loudermilk and his people. They managed to break onto the base with the deputy guy and free Papa. And this is honestly where I started checking out, because I thought that the paintball story was cool. The shitty ass lawyers getting their comeuppance, all that kind of stuff. That was the cool stuff. Then when all of a sudden the guy who runs the paintball place is ex-CIA and he's at war with this Loudermilk guy and these guys rogue buddies and all this kind of stuff, it just got really fantastic really quickly. But I will give credit, at least the people in the rogue group are somewhat colorful. I mean, literally one of them is a black dude. He's wearing a Nine Inch Nails t-shirt, so I zeroed on him pretty quickly. Got good musical taste. I'm not sure if his wife is Caucasian or Asian. She looks more Asiatic as the series progresses, but she's got like strawberry blondish hair in the first part. She's wearing a Dead Kennedy shirt. Not as into them, but she seems cool, and she's got all kinds of neat like skull rings and spike bracelets and stuff. And then there's another guy who's running around with a cap, and he's like the crazy, sleazy, overly enthused about killing people dude. And then you've got Papa, who's more like the responsible dude. And like, I don't know, they've got personality, which is something that's going to be lacking in some of the other teams we're going to see in the later stories we're going to cover. Solicitation copy for number 3. The CIA Special Task Force searches the New Jersey Pine Barrens, hot on the trail of a predator cutting a bloody swath through the area. Someone else is on the trail too, a team of ex-CIA agents with their own agenda. It's a ferocious pitched battle as the two teams encounter each other, each armed with enough heavy weaponry to take on a predator. And as the humans square off, so does the predator, against another predator that's tracked its quarry through the depths of space to Earth. Will anyone survive the ensuing insanity? And see, getting back to that, as the story progresses, we see that the pursuing ship with the predators inside of it those guys have all been slaughtered. So apparently the crazy killer predator got into there and took these guys out and was such a badass that none of them could stand up to him. And also he had triggered the self-destruct on the ship. And so the rogue CIA agents getting into the ship, they're pursued by the hero predator, and he gets blown backwards by the explosion. Actually, no, sorry, it's not the rogue agents. It's the other CIA guys. See, this is part of the problem with the book, is like you got the rogue guys and they're in plain clothes, and then you've got Loudermilk's people and they're in like black jumpsuits and all this kind of stuff. And then these guys start going to war together because they got this history and stuff. But like, I don't know why the rogue guys are even there, except that Papa is trying to avenge the guys who work for him at the paintball place. Why does he care about the predators? They're fucking with his business and stuff, and they've screwed with his cover identity, but they could just go. And especially the rogue guys, they're only there because Papa is their buddy and he's called them in to help them out. They don't have any beef with the predators. They don't have a history with these guys. Why are they even there? And they're there where all these guys that they're having issues with, all these CIA guys, are actively hunting the predators and them. So it's a really dangerous situation for them to be in, and they're going to waste a lot of money and a lot of time and their lives on this shit. Why are they even here? Loudermilk makes sense because he wants to capture a predator. He wants to be able to study these guys and study their technology and yada, yada, yada. Also, he, well, again, not with any good clear reason, has just such a mad on for these rogue agents, and he wants to have this opportunity to take them out. So it's sort of like, why didn't you guys just leave? And then you're not even part of the equation anymore. I don't know. Anyway, the other thing is that what I liked about the serial was we were getting involved with the various characters and they're getting a little bit more into their personalities, and it was more grounded and relatable. And then once you bring all the CIA shit, everything gets crazy and there's just like an unlimited resources where there's all these CIA guys wandering around in the forest getting taken out by the Predator. So it's just like body count, body count, body count, encounter, encounter, shots fired. It gets kind of confusing after a while. Who's shooting who and why? And again, at the end of the day, the rogue agents are killing other CIA agents. So that's terroristic. That's treasonous. Like, these guys are basically asking for all kinds of hell to rain down on them. And again, why are you even here? What is the rationale for this? And yeah, it's gory and the art's pretty cool. It's different. It's not as polished as you might like. Again, I have to stress, there's a lot of the Anthony Williams and the John McCrae in this equation, but you don't get all the way to the Kevin O'Neill. That influence is clearly there, and that's part of the appeal, but this is not Kevin O'Neill doing an alien story. This is much more like Anthony Williams, Vince Guarano doing a Kevin O'Neill riff. But after all this engagement, eventually the hero Predator is able, his intentions are determined, and Papa gets the surviving members of his rogues to back off and see what they could do with the Predator. Solicitation copy from number 4, and here's a phrase that I'm starting to feel like I should have been drinking shots to. The New Jersey Pine Barrens echo with the roar of a rogue. The serial killer Predator. Xenopedia added a comma there. I don't know if that's from the original solicitation copy or not. He's just taken on another Predator sent to kill him, and now he's gone berserk, attacking anybody he encounters. Now, ex-CIA agents Papa John and friends face a horrific extraterrestrial and the wrath of the U.S. military. These guys are all running around in black outfits. They're not military. Wounded, trapped, with no way out. It's a one-way ticket to hell as they face a Predator who's willing to kill his own kind. Yeah, and at this point, everybody's just killing everybody. Active CIA, rogue CIA, good Predators, bad Predators. It's chaos. At this point, the art is detrimental. It's over-rendered. There's so much going on, so much activity. We've lost the thing that works best. You don't have Evan Dorkin's voice so much anymore. We're not hearing the radio blurbs. We're not hearing the chatter. We're not hearing the guys, you know, talking shit and having personality. It's just shoot, 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 kill, 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 slash, slash, slash. The final chapter is just extremely tedious. The crazy killer Predator finally manages to kill the good guy, hero Predator. He actually stabs him in the chest with his own fucked up crazy mask. The Predator eventually, the crazy Predator manages to jump up onto a helicopter and kill everybody aboard, including Loudermilk. There's a shot with a cool perspective of him holding up the severed head. The Predator then goes back to the ground, manages to net the one guy who's got a bazooka among the ex-CIA guys, and it's phosphorus. So he is immolated. The black dude's immolated. Papa John had seen the severed head of the deputy guy that had been helping him and tried to stuff it down the Predator's throat. Like I said, pretty gory book. Ultimately, he doesn't survive either. And so it's finally down to the girl, the lady, and just randomly she manages to shoot the Predator in the head enough times where it dies. Also, there's this weird thing where the artist keeps putting tribal tattoo shit in as a way of showing action, like it's like his equivalent of speed lines. I've never seen anybody do that before to my recollection. It's very unique. It's kind of distracting, but it's very unique, and credit for that. So everybody's dead except for the lady that we barely know anything about. She's about to kill herself because she's already had her hand damaged, and then a whole bunch of Predators show up in a new ship to rappel down. But what they do instead is they seem to put some sort of thing on her hand. I don't know if it's an enhancement or if it's just something that's supposed to help her to heal, but she manages to escape this big fire that's been caused by the phosphorus. Everybody else is dead. She goes into hiding, and we see her at the very end where she's now got white hair. I don't know if she's supposed to have been so spooked by the Predators that her hair turned white, or if she's under an assumed identity, and that's how it ends. And it's like, this story started out with so much potential. I think that probably what happened is the artist took over, and I think Dorkin maybe lost control of what was happening, or maybe he just seeded that. Maybe he just didn't want to get in the way of the art, cover it up with his captions, so he just didn't. And so it just, the whole thing spirals out of control and gets totally hyperbolic, and most of the miniseries squanders the goodwill that had been produced by the serial for me. There's too much Derek Thompson, not enough Evan Dorkin. What started out as looking like it was going to be the best of the stories I was going to read this time ended up being still better than most of them, to be honest with you. I don't think I've ever talked to you about Predator stuff. We've only ever seemed to talk about alien stuff. It was Predator another one of those ones you watched on the extended play tapes, you know, from HBO Weekend?
Yeah, actually, like, after I got over the horror of it, and it was probably around the same time that I started getting to Alien, and it was kind of funny because it was before I associated the two of them together. Well, no, because I think the comics, gosh, I don't even remember what I told you last time with the comics, but like around that time, I did know there were some crossover in the comics, but I started watching both of them, Aliens and Predator. And of course, because I grew up as a huge G.I. Joe fan. You know, that fueled a lot of my love for the Colonial Marines and Aliens. But there were also a lot of, like, I recognized the Deltas or whatever, like, commando team they were in Predator, Arnold's team. They looked like they were based off of certain G.I. Joes. There was the Native American one. There was the guy with the hat and, like, the minigun and everything. Like, I could spot which guy in his team was based off of which Joe and things like that. And then I could reenact that. I would play that with my figures or something like that. And so, yeah, I loved, like, Predator. It's such, like, unapologetically just shot of testosterone of just the just fuel of seeing these guys who are, everybody in that is like an Ed McGuinness drawing. There's just muscles on top of muscles on top of more like like veins just popping out from underneath their clothes. And then just to see them slaughtered and butchered one by one by this thing that they're just incapable of, like that all of their military might and hardware can't, in similar to Aliens, the sort of metaphor that like this thing is technologically superior. So it doesn't matter how big your gun is. The way that Arnold defeats it is he has to go more primitive, more tribal. He has to use more old-fashioned tricks and sabotage and the type of weapons that, you know, Woodsman would. Which is why I freaking loved the movie Prey, the one that just came out a couple years ago. That was one of the best action movies I've seen forever.
Yeah, that was excellent. I really liked the use of the blood in that one. Mm. And it's nice to have finally seen a Predator movie really take advantage of one of the advantages I think Predator has over Aliens is, I know there's a lot of people who draw like a hard line where Alien, first contact with the aliens is supposed to take place in the movie Alien and nothing ever happened before that. And I'm actually cool with that because I really am not interested in seeing the xenomorphs in different time periods. I don't think that works that well. Because that atavistic quality that the Predators have, it actually feels more right for them to come around into earlier times and interact with different peoples throughout our history. And again, the hunting expeditions that have gone on for centuries, if not millennia. So yeah, actually the movies reflect that, which is something that's such a big part of the expanded universe, particularly the comic books. I don't read the books, but I assume the books touch on that as well. I think that they really touched on a vein there, besides the fact that having like different kinds of people fight the Predator and having, you know, you finally have the classic final girl against the Predator, you know, that we've seen in so many of the other sci-fi horror movies and such, but also just the time period, like doing it in a different time period and seeing how that affects the Predator's technology, our technology, the techniques by which you're able to defeat the Predators. It's just interesting to play around with that sort of element where I don't think that works as well with Aliens.
Right, agreed. Like, yeah, like I even remember when they did Alien versus Predator, like the first movie, and their decision to set it, even though it was like set in like this temple in Antarctica and like it kind of looked like an alien set, but like the idea to set it in contemporary time, that to me seemed more than anything like a budgetary issue. Like they're just like, we don't want to make like more futuristic sets or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
And the funny thing is, you look at the comic books, they really don't have to. Just, you know, give them some interesting outfits and they're roughing it. You know, they're roughing it in 2033 or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. 2333 or whatever that, you know. And with the Predator stuff, did you ever read the comic books with that, the Expanded Universe stuff, or were you mostly just the movies?
I read, a friend of mine had the trade paperback of, I think, Concrete Jungle. Or wait, what was the first one called Concrete Jungle, or was it called Heat or something like that?
I think Concrete Jungle's right. That's how, I think their collection might have been that. You know, sometimes they'll have a title for the miniseries and they rethink it by the time they do the trade. But I think Concrete Jungle's correct.
Was that the one? It was
that was the Chris
like
Warner.
Like it was Dutch's brother or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I remember reading that one. I read, I guess, the first two Batman versus Predator miniseries, which I actually liked, and I thought they got creative because it was set in the urban city. It repeated a lot of the same tropes from Predator 2. For all of its many, many faults, I liked that movie too well enough. Predator 2. There were some parts that I thought were kind of dumb, but again, I liked Bill Paxton's performance. It's just like as silly as he was, nothing would take away from what he did in Aliens, but just again being like this kind of crazy guy. Like his death scene in Predator 2 was memorable. I liked Danny Glover too. That was probably maybe the first time where I really remember an African-American actor being like the main final action hero to go toe-to-toe with a monster and walk away. I don't know if it, or yeah, what else
it done that? In the sci-fi milieu, I'm not sure. I'd have to double check to see if there was any earlier examples of that.
Yeah, he still managed to capture a little bit of the everyman quality with being afraid of heights and being too old for this shit without actually saying.
And you got the re-teaming with Gary Busey besides.
yes, of course. It's nowhere near as good, but I did. I could enjoy Predator 2. I could watch that if I needed to.
You do seem to have carried on with the Predator movies, though, at least.
I did not see the Adrian Brody one. I think that's the only one I missed.
Yeah, so you saw Requiem?
Yeah. So, as much as I hated Alien vs. Predator, I thought the sequel, okay, the sequel's gotta be better. And me, my wife, we were just either just dating or just engaged at the time, and her brother-in-law, we saw that movie Christmas night. So, like, after we had done all of the family Christmas stuff, okay, when everything was all settled down and everything, and we didn't have kids at the time or whatever, so, like, we were just like, all right, we want to see this movie, nothing else to do, it's Christmas night. We went to the theater to see Alien vs. Predator Requiem, and I was like, I don't know how they did it, but they managed to make it worse. And it was one of those things where it was like, the tagline was like, no matter which one wins, we lose. I'm like, no kidding. I was like, I've never been in one of these versus competitions where I was like, I kind of hope everybody dies.
Right.
Alien, Predator, human being, audience, director, everybody.
Well, and speaking of Lethal Weapon alumni, did you catch The Predator by Shane Black?
Yes. Yeah, I did see that one. Fine. I didn't care much for it, but it was, I think I watched that one and then saw Prey soon thereafter, and it was just like so much miles ahead that right. I kind of locked the other one out of my head. So
it's not typical.
Predator Kindred was a 4-issue limited series with cover dates ranging from December 1996 through March 1997. Covers were by Igor Corday, and they're pretty damn nice. I liked many of the covers on this one. It's just that none of them were specific enough to the story to where I wanted to use it for the album art, but especially the first issue's cover, which features a predator holding up a human skull as though it's presenting it to the audience, I think is a fairly iconic predator image. Really, really well painted. Cordy got massively screwed over in the early 2000s by the X-Men office, and it pretty much meant he didn't get work in the comic industry by and large after that, and it's a real shame. He has done some really good work in the field. The miniseries was written by Jason R. Lamb and Scott Tolson. Both of these guys were local writers in the Oregon area. I'm not really seeing that they did much else besides this. They did a little bit of work for Dark Horse, particularly on some of the Star Wars books, I think, but aside from a little bit of stuff here and there for Dark Horse, doesn't really seem like they went anywhere. Pencils on the first two issues are by Brian O'Connor. This is a guy who entered that pipeline of comics to animation where he was doing storyboards and creature designs for Industrial Light and Magic, eventually started doing work on the Clone Wars cartoon series on Cartoon Network. So probably one of these dudes who had comic books as sort of a layover or as an access point. Obviously, Dark Horse had a relationship with Star Wars, and maybe he got funneled through that. Has an interesting style. The earlier pages recall Peter Snejberg to me, but then as the series progresses, it looks a little bit more like Chris Sprose, but moodier. Also, one thing I will say as a criticism is a lot of the people have the same faces. They all kind of look like middle-aged guys, even the lady. Halfway through the series, the art switches over to a fellow named Roger Peterson. Not as detailed, a little more minimalist, a little bit of Tim Sale in there. I like them both overall, despite my little shot at O'Connell. And it was weirdly smooth transition. It took me a minute going into the third issue before I started to realize that there was a different artist. Probably contributing to that were the inks of Bruce Patterson. Patterson is an excellent inker. He's definitely one of the guys who, if he's doing an assignment, I'm assured. One of these days, I need to put together a mental list of the top 10 inkers. There's a very good chance he'd be on it. He does great work. And he's versatile. Like, I tend to associate Patterson with that crackling energy that he has for a lot of his DC work. He's a little bit like Terry Austin in that respect, but I think Austin's a little bit more limited. If you don't give him the right kind of penciler that lets him use his little staccato lines, his dashes and stuff, he seems like he doesn't really click. And I never really found Austin to be particularly good on more gritty, realistic stuff. He tends to do the superhero stuff better. Where Patterson, I would have no idea that he had inked this project. I think there's not only fidelity to the pencils, but it's just not in a style that I would associate with him. There's no flash to this. It's just a good little moody, rich inking job. Kudos to the fellow. So the publisher summary on the first issue: Fleener Creek, Oregon is a typical small northwestern town, one that is ready to blow sky high with the repressed emotions in the hearts of the townspeople. And there to light the fuse is one of the most unrepressed killers in the cosmos. A community will either draw together or destroy itself when four kindred spirits are drawn to the forest. An action-starved sheriff, a serial killer, family man Buddy Wilcox, and a predator. The same one who killed Buddy's father right in front of him in those very woods 30 years before. Which, by the way, is a sticking point. Number one, they really don't indicate that there's a relationship between them two. I mean, predators all kind of look alike, so call me a predator bigot, whatever have you. The story itself doesn't really strongly indicate that these are the same predator really until the fourth issue. The Buddy character clearly recognizes the predator when he sees that being, I believe, in the third issue and responds in a very strong way because of that. But again, as a person who's reading the story, I'm not realizing that he's seeing the actual predator responsible for his dad's death. I just assume that these were two different predators and he's just encountering another predator. Another thing is that 30-year gap. Xenopedia makes note of this too. We both caught this. The story starts with the character as a 9-year-old in 1958. And the guy looks believably like he could be pushing 40 in the story. He's reasonably well-maintained. He's a tall, big, brawny fellow, but he still can definitely look middle-aged. The problem is the story is being produced in 1996, and they do refer to it as though it's in the present day, but the timeline doesn't work if you think that's the case. Really, the story needs to be taking place in 1988. I don't recall there being anything within the setting that would foil that being the case, but it's just weird that they don't designate that and they treat it as an 8-year gap. And so just to elaborate a little bit on that plot. So again, the story opens up with our lead character as a boy. He's out camping with his dad for the first time. His dad's a macho military guy, has no problem slapping his son on the mouth if he doesn't like what he's doing, doesn't want him reading comic books, snatches one out of his hand, throws it in the campfire. This hunting trip is the boy's first, and he's his opportunity to show himself becoming a man, and we need to put aside these childish things. But Mr. Macho runs into a predator and gets hacked to pieces. Then we have a time jump again, says the present day, where our guy is middle-aged, he's a family man, he's got two young kids at home with a loving wife, he's defined as a guy who's essentially pacifistic, he doesn't get angry, he doesn't get upset with his kids, he's always cool, even tempered. And then it transitions to the female sheriff. She's inherited that role from her father. She runs around with a gigantic, dirty, hairy hand cannon. People ask why, because she's in a small town where there was a murder decades ago, probably the one that, you know, the kid's dad being killed. And so there's really no reason for her to have such an elaborate weapon. But again, the times are changing. You switch over to the TV where we see them talking about this murderous cult that went on a spree killing, and we see them in the jail. They're talking about how they've gotten off by reason of insanity. They're going to be transferred to an asylum. It's, I think, 3 or 4 guys, and they're not only are they killers, but they're a warped religious cult. They believe that the main guy is some sort of a prophet. They like to like skin people alive to help them to see their own souls and all this transcendental sadism. It's nutty. So from the first issue, I was struggling with the story because there's just lots of stuff that don't add up. The first thing is it's clear that they're transitioning from the boy to the adult version of the boy. But then when they transition from the adult boy to the sheriff, there's no, it seems like they should be connected, but they're not connected. At no point in the series are they ever connected in the past. They end up together toward the end of the story, but it makes you think that she's got a role to play, like maybe she's a sibling or maybe she had a similar experience, and we never get to see that. And so it just, because of how they do the transitions, especially because they transition mid-page from the guy to the sheriff, you're thinking there's something there and there just isn't. So there's problem number one. Problem number two is the feds are interviewing the leader of the cult, and again, they're pissed off that this guy's essentially gotten off, even though he's obviously going to Arkham Asylum or wherever, so it's not like he's getting released out into the public, and he's still clearly a Looney Tune and he's openly antagonizing the guys. But having gone through a court proceeding, that takes months if not years to get to that point. And as part of his antagonizing of the feds, they never found out where the body of one of the feds that the cult had gotten a hold of and killed had gotten to. And then the killer starts coughing and he coughs up a human digit. It looks like a thumb. And supposedly it's identified as being the feds, but it's like, this guy's been in jail for months. There's no way he has an undigested thumb that he could hack up on demand, right? This thing would have been, you know, maybe the bones would have still been in his gut, but I'm pretty sure he'd have shit that out. So it just doesn't make any sense. Now, it's possible maybe he was running around with that up his boo-boo the whole time, and he was just waiting until that last day to swallow the thumb that he'd been holding on to in some sort of a gold watch kind of situation. That would certainly be more interesting than just the complete lack of awareness of biological function being displayed here. But beyond that, the entire cult has been determined to be insane by a jury of their peers. It's a lot harder to prove that 4 people all went insane and were unable to know right from wrong and therefore need to go to an asylum to have mental checks and stuff. It goes back to like the Charlie Manson thing. One person going completely nuts, especially temporary insanity, that's already tough enough to prove and unlikely to make it to that person being institutionalized. But for 4 people all working in conjunction with one another, they basically check each other because one of these 4 people should have been sane enough to stop the other guys from doing the killing. We don't typically believe that 4 people at one time are going to go insane and do insane stuff, especially if it's not like this is a massacre. They've already got guns. They've made plans. They've descended upon people to kill them. They've tortured people. They've done all this kind of stuff. That shows a level of premeditation that refutes insanity. So you're beginning from a pretty faulty premise there. And so the story continues where the buddy guy, he has a mechanic shop and he's got people in his employ. employ, including a young woman who is experiencing spousal abuse, and he's consoling her. He's telling her she needs to just end it because it's never going to end on its own, and she knows he's right, and blah, blah, blah. It's going to play up later on. So this is the part where I really started struggling with the story, is that the feds are driving behind the prison van that's taking the four convicts slash insane asylum inductees to where they're going to go. And so they're basically told to pull over by the feds, and then the feds and the police are leading the prisoners deep into the woods. Now, you can pretty well figure out where this is going. The intention is they're going to execute these motherfuckers before they ever make it to the asylum. And one of them does get shot in the head. In fact, apparently the feds and the police did not collaborate on this. So after having led these prisoners into the woods under really shady circumstances, now at least one of the local guards is protesting and refusing to allow the execution of the other prisoners. I think anybody who's been experiencing all the thin blue line bullshit of the last few years should know that that's not how that shit would work out. We would never be in a place where the cops were taking the prisoners into the woods if the police were not already collaborating with the feds with the intent of killing these guys. They're totally blowing protocol. These are also two different authorities, two different jurisdictions. You're not going to get these one group to follow the orders blindly of another group, and then when people start dying, then they're like, hey, wait, we've got to protect these people. No, they'd be in cahoots. They would have gotten together. They'd have killed these guys. Actually, I think what they would have done is they'd have probably drove the van into the river and let those guys all drown and just say it was an accident or make it look like an accident. And all the cops managed to get out and the feds were there to help them, and they'd be heroes for killing these people. We all know it wouldn't be this kind of situation. You don't have to have like advanced knowledge of how cops work to know this wouldn't be how things work out. They would not have a Mexican standoff where the cops and the feds all manage to kill each other, and the ones that they don't kill get killed by the prisoners who in the scuffle have managed to get a hold of guns and taken control of the situation. All kinds of ridiculous. Not how anything works. My girlfriend was watching a show. I won't identify it, but the entire show is extremely contrived. In the season finale, there's a person who escapes from a prison by getting a hold of a key card that gives them access to the street from the prison. I can assure you there's no major metropolitan area in which you don't have to go through human beings to get to the exterior. You are going through multiple checkpoints. It's unavoidable. They're going to eyeball you. They're going to know you because the same people are in there all the time. It's the same cops. It's the same staff. It's the same prisoners. Generally, you know, you've got some turnover, but again, it's not as hard. You're not as worried about the prisoners because you're in an orange jumpsuit. Those are the guys that don't get to go out of any doors and you're going to be controlling. There's no, I stole somebody's badge and I'm keying out to walk out the fucking door. The difference though is that's a show where everything is ridiculous like that, and you have a buy-in because of the type of show that is. You're just going to accept that it's not based in an objective reality. This is trying to have it both ways where, yeah, I know that there's an alien that's hunting people and stuff, but otherwise it's trying to be grounded, except that it does nonsensical stuff. So as the issue progresses, the abusive husband comes and puts a beating down on the big brawny buddy guy who's like a military vet and stuff, but he's a pacifist. He's not willing to fight back. He takes the beating without defending himself. So we're showing that he's not like his father, specifically intentionally not the same way. And so of course his arc is going to be, well, what happens when he runs to the predator again? Meanwhile, the deputies of the sheriff have gone out hunting and end up being hunted. And that's one of the inciting factors of the story. Synopsis for issue number 2. A small northwestern town's heart of darkness is laid bare when evil comes to call. McCutcheon is a serial killer who finds himself no longer the hunter, but the hunted. As the authorities in some thing chase him through the forest. Kelly Mathis is a small town sheriff who must face old fears as she encounters the boogeyman of her childhood. Buddy Wilcox is a family man whose father's brutal slaying still haunts him years later. 30 years ago, a predator came to town. Now these four kindred spirits are drawn together toward an explosive conclusion. So the bit where they talk about the sheriff's trauma or facing a boogeyman and all that kind of stuff, this is still just stories related to the death of the dude's dad. So she's not really connected to this. The whole town, I guess, is connected to one of their own being killed, but it's kind of a reach to make that like a specific motivation for her character. Oh, and I forgot to mention, I think it's actually the serial killers that kill the deputies, or at least one of the deputies, and then the predator sets upon them, and the predator ends up killing everybody but the lead serial killer guy. So aside from, I guess, needing a bunch of guys to help kill their way out of custody, you've introduced this cult of serial killers, which seems like an interesting angle, and then you wipe out all of them by the second issue. If that's the case, why not make the main guy like Hannibal Lecter, and he gets out on his own, and then he seems more formidable. formidable. But in fact, the story makes a point of undermining him, because after he escapes the Predator, he's traumatized by what he's seen, and yet he's all supposed to be the big bad Predator himself who hunts other humans and skins them and stuff. And so he starts seeing the ghosts of his cohorts telling him, you know, this is our God. This is what we've been waiting for. This is what we've been trying to conjure. You're the Messiah, and this is our deity, and you should be embracing this, and blah, blah, blah. And I guess that works okay too, but it's like, you happen to have four serial killers, and you're not going to do anything with four serial killers aside from killing some deputies. You're going to kill three of them off and have the one guy just sort of float around for the miniseries. You didn't need the other three guys to do that. And see, the sheriff is investigating the disappearance of her deputies. She finds the serial killer guy, but he's playing innocent. And so she is a smart cop. She recognizes that if there's a bunch of blood and there's one guy, that guy is immediately your first suspect. So she set on taking him into protective custody at the least. So throughout the issue, we get into the domestic violence situation. At one point, the girl kisses the guy, the buddy guy, because she's grateful for the help and for the beating that he took and all this other kind of stuff. But she's realizing more and more that she's going to need to do something, or her guy's never going to stop. And she tries to stand up to him when he's saying that she was cheating on him and catting around and stuff. And then he loses it and he starts running after her he chases her out of a trailer with a knife, a kitchen knife. And it seems like he's intent on finally murdering her. So again, we've done this build up to where she's supposed to finally confront her domestic abuser. She really doesn't. And it seems like she's about to get murked, but instead it draws the attention of the Predator, who chops the dude to pieces and he looks like Elvis. And I think maybe he's supposed to be based on the dentist from Little Shop of Horrors. And that's where that second issue ends. Third issue synopsis: the sleepy town of Fleener Creek isn't so sleepy anymore. Young Sheriff Kelly is on the trail of a psychopathic killer while Buddy Wilcox hunts the forest for his childhood obsession, a monster the other town folk believe exists only in his imagination, a Predator. The dark underbelly of this little community has finally been exposed, and like raw flesh hitting sunlight for the first time, it's going to burn. So this is where you think stuff is going to start happening, because Sheriff Kelly recognizes that, hey, if we've got the body of this domestic abuser guy, and they have a connection to the buddy guy, and people are always wondering if the buddy guy killed his own dad since nobody really bought the alien story. The only problem is, of course, 9-year-olds butchering a full-grown adult and hanging them from trees and stuff. Not very likely there. But again, that makes Buddy a suspect. She recognizes that, and Sheriff Kelly goes and arrests him, but she's kind of a jerk about it. And of course, we, the audience, know that Buddy isn't guilty. So even though in the police playbook it works out, it doesn't make you endeared to her character that she had to do it in the way that she did it. Especially since Buddy was kind of having a good day. She harshed his mellow. And so having taken Buddy in, Sheriff Kelly gets his story, which is, you know, he elaborates for pages and pages about what happened to his dad. But really all it tells us is that the boy froze, and that because of the abuse he was suffering from his dad, he had wished upon a falling star that his dad would die and leave him alone. And then the Predator shows up, having been the falling star, with his spaceship, kills the dad, and not only kills the dad, but skins the dad, does all this kind of stuff to him. The Predator makes the boy watch this whole time, and in fact, sort of marks the kid with the dad's blood at one point. The Predator knows that the kid is frozen solid, and he's just sort of like, hey, watch me do this, you know? I'm your new daddy now. But see, for the most part, we already knew that from the flashback from the first issue, so elaborating upon that in the third issue only gets us so far. And then, of course, the town folk had been deputized to go check and see what happened to the other deputies, and then they turn on the sheriff because they assume that Buddy was a killer this whole time, and so they want to kill him in his jail cell and do some vigilante justice and stuff. And you're thinking, okay, well, you know, we're going in this direction. Okay, that's cool. Things are heating up. Things are getting involved. You know, I guess we're going to work through this. But no, what happens is there's a standoff, and then the Predator just comes through the roof and starts wrecking everything and releases the serial killer guy, so he doesn't have to do anything for himself. He just keeps having stuff done for him by cops who are incompetent killers and by his fellow serial killers and now the Predator. It's like, is this guy ever going to do anything for himself? We don't have to worry about the rogue vigilantes anymore because the Predator's taking those guys out. But he hasn't taken out the cop, of course, because we need to have do stuff with the cop later on. So the serial killer guy, since he's loose and he's one of the only people who's still conscious, and apparently the Predator wants to run with him later on, he's like, okay, well, I'm going to show the Predator what I can do, and he's going to accept me as one of his own, and we're going to be like killers together. Or actually, I'm going to kill my God to assert my God, but first I'm going to kill a bunch of people. It's serial killer logic, leave it alone. And so at one point he kisses the lady cop while she's unconscious, but he doesn't kill her, he doesn't kidnap her, he just wanders off and does like kooky singing songs and being a goofball and the kind of shit that you have in media representations of mental illness. And then the buddy guy, because he's just seen a Predator and he's freaked out, they've already set up that he's got a locked basement that nobody is ever allowed to go into. And so his wife finally follows him down into there, and she sees him in his socks and boxer pants, holding a spear with face paint on and a saber-toothed necklace. And then there's all these images, these clippings from newspapers about the death of Kennedy and serial killers and aliens and just all this stuff. So he's like a nutty conspiracy theorist this whole time. Apparently he's been researching the predators to the best of his ability. He's got some samurai armor and stuff. Synopsis for number 4. Fleener Creek was a sleepy old town, all right. Like Andy and Barney could have walked right down Main Street on their way to fetch a little slice of Aunt Bee's apple pie. Boy, that's a reference that I probably ought to stop and explain, but I'm not gonna. But sleepy towns aren't always so dreamy. Sometimes sleep brings on nightmares. The kind that begin and end with an 8-foot tall monster wielding spears and knives and all sorts of weapons. Fleener Creek may have been sleepy, but most of the folks in this town won't sleep sound again. Not for a long time. And others will never wake up. So yeah, all the people that the predator just knocked out and didn't kill, because that's a thing that predators tend to do, they get their weapons together, they get deputized, the Sheriff Kelly's dad puts a bunch of band-aids on his forehead and she deputizes him. I don't know why she waited this long. So the buddy guy, he keeps putting on his armor because I guess he got caught by his wife mid-suiting up. He apparently knows enough about the predators where he's created a facsimile of their armor, their bladed gauntlets, stuff like that. He's going to go out and kill the predator that killed his dad and finally get his closure. But it's like, okay, you've been running around this whole time being a super pacifist, not fighting anybody else outside of the war, because they do, if I remember correctly, they make it seem as though he was in Vietnam. But otherwise, he's just total pacifist, but now he's going to be like a total killer predator, tough enough to take on an actual predator. It's a twist. And so even though there's been manhunts for the serial killer and the predators are, of course, can turn invisible and there's you don't necessarily know where they're going to be going, the lady cop on her own, even though she's supposed to have deputies, but on her own, she manages to find the serial killer who's carved a cross on his face. And then right behind them comes Buddy, the fake human predator. And then, of course, the real predator. And so everybody's fighting and but through the other two predator guys, the serial killer and the cop are attacking each other. And it's one of these instances where it's bad storytelling to my mind, is the layout for this happening is you see the lady cop with a knife in her shoulder, and then way off to the right, you see the serial killer throwing the knife. And it's like, if they'd reversed those positions, then I might've been looking to see what the serial killer was throwing, but starting the page with the knife on one side, I don't know. There's a panel up there where he's pulling back with the knife. I guess it makes some kind of sense, but I just didn't like how that was set up. And then the lady cop Kelly shoots serial killer in the knee, but she's bleeding from her shoulder wound. So she runs away, she's run out of ammo. And so she's running away. And admittedly, the serial killer guy does have a rifle with him, but also he just got shot in the knee. How is he supposed to be following her when she runs away? She could just run away. I'm pretty sure once you get shot in the knee, you're not really going anywhere. And then meanwhile, with the two predators, the actual predator is of course owning the fake predator, but it's just not as definitive as you would think it would be given the strength differences, the skill differences, the fact that one of these guys was raring to go the whole time where the other guy is just warming up to violence. Lady cop gets shot in the back, but she's wearing a bulletproof vest so that mutes most of the damage caused by the shotgun, especially at a range. There's the whole thing where the predator gets his helmet knocked off and he starts quoting the guy's dad back to him about making a man out of him. And instead of continuing to fight the boy and finish off the boy, he gives him a minute to breathe, throws him a blade so that he gets one more chance to put up a good fight. And sure enough, Buddy chops off the predator's arm. It's the right arm. It's the arm with the bomb on it. I think that there's a strong indication that this story might actually have a continuation, but it's not made explicit. We'll see what you think when that gets addressed later on in the episode. Although the predator is grievously wounded, in the end, the buddy guy starts remembering his humanity, starts remembering his more pacifistic inclinations, remembers the fact that his wife told him that if you leave the house with that spear, we're not going to be here when you get back. And so he has his moment of truth, maybe a little too late. But what he does do is rush off to try to help Kelly, the lady cop. There's a lot going on. I'm not sure how much he contributes to her not drowning or otherwise being killed by the serial killer when he actually managed to rush up on her and pull her into a lake and start drowning her. And it's like, this dude's been kneecapped. What the fuck's going on here? So then the spaceship takes off because the predator has been wounded and he's trying to get out of this situation because, again, that's what predators do. They don't stick around to finish the fight or die on the ground. They freak out and go hop their spaceship and run away. But that trips out the serial killer guy and he's all like, "Father, no! I haven't had a chance to prove my worth and kill you." And again, the serial killer thinks that he's the disciple slash child. And then there's the other guy who's sort of the child of the predator. And it's really clumsy and contrived that all this is happening. But while he's distracted, Lady Cop pulls the knife out of her shoulder, embeds it into the sternum of the serial killer guy. And just for good measure, Buddy stabs him in the head with his gauntlet. And also, it looks like the predator ship crashes. So more reason to think that maybe this one predator is just a massive fuck up, and maybe he likes this buddy guy because he's the fuck up predator that some other predator was trying to make a predator out of and seemingly failed. And so you have two codas. One is 3 weeks later, Sheriff Kelly is in bed. She has nerve damage to her right arm that's going to prevent her from ever using a hand cannon in that arm again. So she immediately starts trying to use her hand cannon with the other arm, the left arm. So she's not going to give up. And meanwhile, Buddy's calling his wife and kids where they're staying with relatives, and he's trying to convince them, hey, look, I'm okay now. Come home. I love you. And wife's like, eh, we'll talk later. And the strong indication is he's lost his family over his embrace of manliness. So then he happens to have his father's skull still. That's what happens. You know, when you're a 9-year-old boy and your dad gets killed, they let you keep the skull. I didn't know if you guys knew that. And so Buddy buries the skull, which I have to assume he actually must have dug up at some point in adulthood so he have a copy of it. Or maybe he's just decided that one of the many skulls that were produced by the Predator recently is going to serve as his dad's skull. Either way, this dude's nut job. And he also buries like a can of beer because his dad gave him beer that first hunting trip. And he buries his hunt Predator gauntlet and he says goodbye. And it's like the end. And there's a dedication. Dedicated with love and respect to Thomas W. Tolson, Thomas R. Lamb, and Herbert Gandy Jr., all three fathers and sons who carry the weight upon their backs with a lot of pain, little complaint, and even less appreciation. So this was a weird-ass story with lots of weird-ass elements that didn't make a lot of sense and betrayed that the people writing that story lacked life experience and did not have resources to draw from in the mid-90s to know how many times they were fucking up things that you need to know if you're going to write about. But also, there's a lot of that sense of somebody processing something over the course of the story. There are depths reflected the way the story is being told. And so that's why, there was a point where I was about done with this story. I was just going to drop it and just sort of start flipping through it. But it got me back in again. I missed a few pages, but I ended up reading most of the miniseries. It was okay. It was interesting. It's not something I'd want to read again. But given how most of these Predator stories go, I at least appreciate that someone found a way of taking something personal to them and putting it into the Predator story. I just wish that an editor, another set of eyes, had gone over this thing, pointed out some of the flaws, and corrections could have been made. It sure ain't no classic, but I feel bad bagging on it too much because I do feel like the people who made this thing, this probably meant something to them. In particular, the writers don't have many other credits, so this is one of the only things they got to do. I want them to be able to hold on to this. The artists did a pretty good job. They didn't have a lot of comics work. At least one of them went on to other things, so good for them. As the Predator story goes, pretty solid. I would have liked to have seen these guys develop further.
So what about the other movies? You mentioned you jumped from Predator to Predators, and there's a bunch of stuff in between and afterwards. Does any of that other stuff mean anything to you? Or is it just more of the same?
Predator 2. I really like Predator 2 as well. I don't think I appreciated it at the time, but the Bill Paxton, right?
Yes, he's in that one. And Vasquez is in that one as well, if I remember correctly.
Exactly.
It's Rachel Ticketon in that one. She was from another Schwarzenegger movie, but you had, well, maybe, no, yeah, yeah.
Total Recall.
Yeah.
Maria Conchita Alonso.
I think I'm merging Near Dark and Predator 2, but it's really just Bill Paxton that's coming in from Predator, from Aliens, and then you've got Gary Busey coming in from Lethal Weapon, Danny Glover coming in from Lethal Weapon, and you've got, I think, Rachel Ticklin coming in from Running Man or Total Recall.
Try these instead.
What is it?
It's the original video from the Bakersfield Massacre, before they edited for broadcast.
Yeah.
Is a hodgepodge of people that were active in the action genre and big vehicles that all got stuck together in Predator 2.
Yeah, I think I saw it after Batman Predator. I don't think Predator sells the concept of what it's doing because there aren't so many civilians in the Predator world. It does it a little bit, but once Predator comes into like a built up area, you much more get the sense of that thing of like, he doesn't just kill anyone, or they don't just kill anyone. They kill people that are threats or trophies worth having. And you get that a bit more once it's in the city. So I think I appreciated that in Predator 2. And that was another one that I saw as a pirate. It was already a stuffy, sweaty movie. If you throw in the pirate video quality to it as well, it felt like watching it in a swamp. That had the qualities of like the Chuck Dixon, DiMaggio, Batman Predator 3 as well, which I really, really enjoyed. But otherwise, film-wise, yeah, I've not seen any of, like, for example, the Alien Predators. What, there's one more Predator solo movie, right, after Predators?
You got Prey and you got The Predator.
Okay, so Prey I tried to watch and couldn't engage with it. I don't know if I was tired and being a parent got in the way, but I enjoyed it up to a point, but just didn't bother with it. And I think what it might have missed for me is that sort of big Predator music. It felt relatively quiet compared to Predator 1 and 2.
At the end of the day, it is a TV movie. It's an elevated TV movie, I guess you could say.
Okay. But
it's still ultimately a TV movie for a streamer. You can only expect so much from it. If it's not what you want to see, it's not what you want to see. If you gave it a proper chance and it just didn't grab you, you know, that's not your fault.
Yeah, well, I honestly, I feel like context has a lot to do with my enjoyment of a lot of stuff of late. You know, coming to it after reviews, before reviews, late at night on a Friday when I'm after a couple of glasses of wine and dinner or stuff, is something that I want to go back to because I've heard a lot of good stuff and I do like Predator stories in general. I can barely stay awake for it, and I think a lot of it is just, like I say, just missing that that big Predator. I can't remember the name of the guy who did the score for the Predator films, but I love that. I'll listen to that music on its own, but the name escapes me.
Yeah, I did enjoy the scaled down technology in earlier point into their evolution. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's an enjoyable movie. I did like it, but I think that people treated it as some sort of a revelation in part because there'd been so many bad Predator movies for so long that to have one that was solid, that made it seem like it was genius. And it's like, it's a nice movie. It's a good flick. I liked it, but it's not going to be one of my favorites. I'm not going to have it on heavy rotation or anything. I'm just relieved that I enjoyed one for a change.
Yeah. No, it does feel very much like a character who, like, maybe more so than Aliens. I feel like Predator can go into the, you know, you were saying previously about the Superman Aliens 2 where the aliens were too secondary. I feel like the Predator can do with being too secondary because it's not a particularly complex character. It's a vehicle. Yeah, I was thinking back to like Magnus Predator, like the other Predator crossovers, the Magnus Predator. Tarzan Predator was an interesting one because I was unable to reread it. I love the art, and then listening to you guys talk about it, I was like, yeah, that was an awful, like, I really like Walt Simonson, but I don't know what was going on with that comic.
I get where you're coming from. My feeling is that the aliens bring certain themes with them. And regardless of how involved the aliens are in it, you still want to address the themes that are relevant to the concept. Where ultimately predators are about hunting and human beings are the game.
And having like a code of honor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, you have legal game. And one of the stories that comes up is that sometimes you have a predator that goes off the reservation, is not hunting the people they're supposed to be hunting, and are shunned by the other predators. And so they're not keeping up with their cultural mores. But broadly speaking, you can ascribe honor to the predators, but honestly, I think it's more like with hunting, there may be people who feel a sense of empathy for the animals that they're stalking, but ultimately some people are just about the game. This is legal, this isn't. I'm not going to be shunned because I'm going after illegal game. I'm not going to hunt endangered species or anything, but otherwise I don't really care how I kill it, how long it takes to die. So you have some variances there. I don't think that it's necessarily about honor. I think it's more about not losing your standing within their culture and not going out of bounds in a way that's going to get you kicked off the hunting grounds or get kicked out of your hunting club. I don't see the predators necessarily as being honorable because they are ultimately murderers of sentient beings. You can get into the morals of hunting in general, but, you know, there's a difference between something that's sentient, that has a society, that has, you know, all the trappings that you know, recognize within your own society, and just something, a wild animal out in a field somewhere. I think you can play around with honor as a concept for the predators, but I don't go into it assuming that they're honorable creatures. Individual stories can play with whether or not they are honorable. But it's really a premise. At some point, people are going to be hunted as though they were game by predators. And then you can kind of do whatever you want to from that point onward. As long as that's happening, you have a predator story. Because they've intentionally not told us very much about the culture. We don't go to their planet. They don't have some sort of, you know, cycle that you have to go through. It's, they show up, they hunt people. Anything else is fair game in terms of storytelling. They are more of a premise than they are, you know, there's not a lot of themes there. There's not a lot of intellectual elements that you have to bring into the story. You can tell whatever you want to, or you want to tell, as long as it ultimately involves these guys hunting people.
Yeah. I think when I think of the honor piece, I think specifically of the end of Batman Predator, where they give him a sword or a gun or something, some antique gun or sword as a trophy for having defeated a predator. And then it comes back in 3, I think. But you're bang on. They're not exactly admirable characters ever.
Well, and then Dave Gibbons too likes to point out that, hey, I did that first before they turned up in Predator 2.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's some people say it's parallel thinking, but he thinks that no, they took it directly from his story. It's a a pretty specific thing to have happen in two different stories. So I tend to favor Gibbon's interpretation.
I'd forgotten the end of Predator 2, I think. I think that merits a rewatch.
Dark Horse Presents number 119, cover dated March 1997, features the story No Beast So Fierce. As with, to my knowledge, all Dark Horse Presents stories from the first volume, it's in black and white. Publisher's summary reads, in pursuit of an evil of a different kind, a mismatched band of hunters set out on a trek in the jungle. But are they prepared to meet a predator and face judgment under his code of honor? The game comes courtesy of Mike W. Barr, Scott Collins, and Dan Schaefer. I'll go ahead and read Xenopedia's plot as well. Rich widow Mrs. Trask hires several hunters to slay a man-eating lion that killed her husband, Cirrus. With the hunters patrolling the jungles, one group is ambushed and killed by a predator. The other group reaches the lion's cave, and the beast suddenly attacks them, only to be netted. The predator then slaughters the rest of the hunters. Turning its attention to the restrained lion, he removes his gear and releases it using his wrist blades, preparing to fight the man-eater in a duel. That is a weird plot synopsis because it misses kind of the whole point of the story. Mrs. Trask wants revenge against the lion, and it's a hero lion. It's got like an X scar on its face, if I remember correctly. And when they have the lion captured, she insists that she's going to be the one to kill it. But then when things go awry, she ends up getting swarmed by ants and the ant spider, and I guess presumably she dies by a bunch of ant bites, but I guess there's some kind of special African ants because as drawn, they just look like a bunch of ants. I know you wouldn't feel great after all those bites, but I don't think they're enough to kill an old lady, or especially incapacitate her before she could shoot a gun at minimum the lion, right? And that's the whole point of the story, is that she wants this revenge. She's gathered all these people to get the revenge. The irony is she doesn't get her revenge, and the predators fight each other. The humans weren't really part of the equation. It's not a good story. It doesn't have a real point. I'm making it seem like, oh, this is the point, but no, it's just a bullshit DC horror anthology attempt at a twist that needed a little bit more work on it. This is another instance of Mike W. Barr working with aliens or predators, and it's just not working out. I don't think this sort of thing is in Barr's skill set. Scott Collins' art is transitioning from the style he used when he worked at Malibu to his more familiar style at DC Comics, so it's going to contrast against another story that he does later in our episode where he's more recognizable. The work here is decent enough. I think that it could benefit from color, though. And finally, boy, that's a pretentious title for such a basic-ass story.
Other comics? I don't think so. And actually, in one of the books that we're reading for this one, there is a 4-page preview for Predator Hell in Hot Water, which was written by Mark Schultz. So talk to Darren and Ruth Sutherland about that one. And illustrated by Gene Colan, who I love, but I've never read this one. The preview looks like it's the Predator swimming in the ocean fighting two giant squid.
Yeah, I think I remember that when that one was coming out.
I think it's that underwater or what. But.
Yeah, I think that's one of the ones that came out while I was having a shot myself. So I'm a little bit stronger association with that one than some of the other ones because, and also just weird. Gene Colan doing Predator is just like a weird choice.
Yeah. He was, around this time period, he was kind of all over some of that stuff. I love his work. I can't say he's necessarily suited for all of this stuff. Although, I don't know that I would make him assign him to a Predator book, but it was an interesting shot in here.
I think Jack Palance as Dracula is probably more in his wheelhouse.
Yeah. Well, he did that for 75 issues, so...
Predator Hell in Hot Water was a 3-issue miniseries with cover dates spanning April through June of 1997, written by Mark Schultz, illustrated by Gene Colan, colored by Gregory Wright. Solicitation copy reads, 2 days ago, the crew of a Chilean fishing vessel saw something fall from the sky. They were into the Humboldt Current, watching the approach of a fast-moving weather front, when they heard a roar like a huge turbine in the sky. The rain swept over them, and through the sheets coming down through the clouds, they saw a vision that at times took on material definition and flickered with an electricity of its own. Captain Rafe Cromartie has a pretty good idea what's down in those cold waters. He's pretty sure he's fishing for predators, but knowing what you're fishing for and knowing how to catch it are two totally different things. One crew member is dead, his skull and spine ripped out, and Matson is missing. That leaves the team no choice. They have to go back into the waters to search for their absent comrade. They're prepared to battle a predator, so they believe they're prepared for the worst. But the horrible truth is that the predator may be the least of their troubles. As if a predator weren't problem enough, Rafe Cromartie has already lost a good part of his crew to the undersea hunt for the predator. Now it looks as though the rest of the crew and Rafe himself are about to fall victim to another undersea horror, a huge tentacled worm creature. It looks as though Rafe and crew are caught between hell and hot water.
Predator Hell and Hot Water is a miniseries that I kept coming back to for the Gene Colan art because I was like, I really want it because it's Gene Colan. And I looked at my comic shop and I've bought it 3 times. So I clearly buy it, sell it, and then somewhere along the line go, maybe it's better than I remember. preparation for this chat, I reread it online and it is dog shit. Like... Mark Schultz. It's one of the worst comics. Reading it conscious that I'm going to talk to you about it, even if only in this kind of condensed format, but reading it with a critical eye rather than just going with the flow very much changes how you interpret everything. That feels like one of the worst comics I've ever read. It's full of Hollywood cliches. The military team and the interaction between those characters is so artificial and just pointless. Yeah, awful, awful comic. There are some excellent Predator comics. That's not one of them.
Yeah, that's one of those deals. They kept trying to make Mark Schultz happen. I think in part because they just wanted to keep him employed since he was such a slow artist. But he was such a great artist that I think maybe they gave him too much credit for the scripts and the plots on some of his books. Because when he does it for other people, it doesn't... I've not read a Mark Schultz script yet that did anything for me. I've tried multiple times. Like, he made John Henry Irons a supporting character in Man of Steel for time here and there, and that character interests me, so I wanted to see how that would work for me. It didn't.
Yeah.
And it's not that he was bad or anything, it was just sort of there, and there was nothing compelling about it. And I've read some of his Dark Horse stuff. I even read a few issues of Cadillacs and Dinosaurs late in the run. You know, I love looking at his pictures, but I don't have anything to say about his stories. I've yet to encounter a book where his story was worth talking about.
Yeah, I picked up the Cadillacs, the Xenozoic Tales paperback that Flesk did, thinking, right, I can just read this all in one go, because it was always a little spotty. It was always quite tricky to find and work out the order of, like, is the graphic novel reprints or is it new stuff? And so I got that collection and I just couldn't do it. It's like, yeah, I get it. It's like Wallywood, inked by Al Williamson or something, you know.
You nailed it, yeah.
I get it. Looks beautiful, but no interest at all.
Yeah. That Frazetta quality and everything, yeah.
Hell in Hot Water was collected into a trade paperback in 1998. It's also been featured in various collections. The Predator Omnibus Volume 3, the Marvel's Predator of the Original Years Volume 2, although at the time of this recording, the contents of that omnibus are in flux, apparently because of content issues. In a rare instance, I don't hate the story as much as somebody else. I don't think it's great. It's extremely formulaic. It's not particularly engaging, but it's fine. There's a moment where, there's a full page actually, where they're showing panel by panel the individual members of the crew that's going after the Predator. And they're each named. And it somewhat recalls the credit sequence from the end of the first Predator movie, where you pause, you see that member, they give you the actor's name. That was one of the fun moments of that movie. Well, certainly one of the most iconic. And so they do that in this comic book, and you're working on the assumption, okay, well, we're going to get to know these people as individuals, or they're going to have big outsized personalities like the pro wrestlers from the first Predator movie, and it's going to matter that they took this time to get us introduced to these characters. Fucking doesn't matter. They're cannon fodder. The fact that one of them gets captured, the other ones have to go try to save that guy, since none of them matter, since we don't get invested with any of them, it's just such a waste of time. It just feels like, wait, we're in the water, then we're out of the water, then we're back in the water to go save the guy that nobody cares about. It does feel very pointless. This is also late career Gene Colan. Gene Colan used to be one of my favorite artists. I sort of lost interest over the years, but I bought a lot of Colan stuff when I was a kid. I know there's a big thing about him painting with pencil and stuff, but I think that Gene Colan needs an inker. I think he's always needed an inker for the most part. I think that they shot from pencils, I think, with the Nathaniel Dusk miniseries in the 1980s. I bought those. I liked those because the pencils were tighter than this. You know, he's a lot older by this point in time, and the pencils are looser. They're definitely tight pencils. I could definitely see somebody going there and not having a whole lot of trouble inking these pages. Everything's reasonably well defined. It just doesn't look that good. Things are a little bit off. Proportions are a little bit off. It just needs some tightening. It needs greater distinction from panel to panel. The storytelling could probably use a little bit of help in terms of making sure the eye is going where you need it to go and being clear what's happening. Like, there's a key instance where the crew is going into the water, and it's probably worth noting, since virtually every Predator story makes a point of telling you how Predators like things hot, and they just have to freaking lean on that in every story. You would think the water would be kind of cold for a Predator, but as it happens, there's a fault and there's thermal pressure coming up, and it's bringing out all of these exotic creatures that normally would not be at attainable depths. They've like come up because of the heat, and so the Predator is hunting these creatures. That's why the Predator's in the water, and the waters are of course very warm or outright hot, I would assume, or the Predator wouldn't be very comfortable there, wouldn't be hunting there. And so they're looking for the Predator. They've lost sight of it. They do find this giant, you know, squid thing. And what happens is the Predator has killed the squid thing and actually burrowed into its body. It's a large enough creature, like almost the size of a whale. So he's able to get inside this creature. And then once they come around, he bursts out of the creature's carcass and attacks, right? Problem number one being this is water, and so you're going to have a lot of resistance and stuff. You're going to have things like, you know, blood floating around and stuff. There's going to be indications that something's happened here, and I just don't think that you could climb out of a creature and spring at somebody underwater. You sneak up on him maybe, but like bursting out like he's supposed to do, he's not Submariner over here. And there's stuff like he's got wavy lines that are indicating like currents and stuff, and it's okay, but it's very old school. It's the sort of thing you probably do with colors now. Speaking of the colors, Gregory Wright, in order to work with all this gray, he's having to do these very pastel colors, and it makes everything seem washed out, which, you know, it's an underwater adventure. I could see some benefit to that. But because they're pastels, you don't really get a sense of them being in the depths. Everything is a little too lighty-brighty. In fact, one of the problems I had is I was trying to pick a cover to use for the album art, and since everything was these bright pastels, they didn't tell you that this was indicating an underwater adventure. One in particular has this bright orange-red background. It's like, they're underwater. Why are you screwing up their ability to tell if they're underwater? Because the coloring didn't work. There's been a lot of discourse this past month or so about the quality of comics today, the health of the industry. Well, somebody who's ranting about how you used to be a priority of the industry to make sure that people who were part of the industry, especially veterans, were consistently getting work, were taken care of. The simple fact is that, like many things in this world, the money men have come in and taken up all the resources, and there's nothing left for anybody else. So there isn't any money for these veterans. Plus, we're in an age where these guys open their mouths and say something stupid and get canceled. If people don't want to buy their stuff because they're exposing themselves to shitty people, that's nobody's fault. It's nobody's responsibility to make sure that people that can't sell anything have some kind of employment. What I'm reminded of is in this time period, even though this was post-bust, 1997 was not a great year for comics, as I recall. Very few years up to 2000 were, but there was still enough money in this industry, and there were enough people who were people running these companies. You know, Dark Horse is owned by some fucking European video gaming outfit. You think they're going to try to find some money to make sure Chris Claremont and John Byrne are still living healthy? They've got royalties, they're fine, but because the discourse brought those guys into the equation, they don't care. And the people who do care don't have the power to do anything about it, don't have the money to do anything about it. But back in the 90s, Mike Richardson still ran his company without any sort of restrictions. He probably had the cash to give somebody like Gene Colan an assignment just to keep him busy. Didn't have to necessarily be good. He didn't necessarily have to be 100% up to it anymore. There were people who were still around who were going to buy it because Gene Colan drew it, and just to support him and to support the community. Another issue too is the community expanded. People forget it used to be a bunch of guys working around each other, knew each other in the New York area. And then, especially in the 80s and 90s, people from all over the world started doing comic books. It's kind of tough to support everybody in the world, especially people that you don't know personally, that are just sending packages or emails. It's not the same kind of relationship. It's not the same kind of industry. So you're trying to apply a circumstance that existed in the past to the present, make comics great again. I'm not saying it isn't noble. I definitely am a believer in the Hero Initiative, and, you know, I want to see some of these older guys continuing to work. I'm just trying to say that the industry is not where it was in 1997, just like the industry in 1997 wasn't where it was in 1977. But one thing that is consistent is that the majority of comics suck, and aside from the novelty of seeing Gene Colan draw predators in water, this comic pretty well sucked. Most things suck, so it always kind of gets me where it's like, oh, everything's horrible, you know, the comics are lousy now, and they've got all the wrong people and doing all the wrong things, especially if it's some politically motivated thing where it just doesn't suit you because you're a fucking dinosaur and you haven't kept up with the times, you're pissed off because you have to look at brown people and gay people and all this other kind of nonsense. This has always been a hard industry. This has always been an industry that breaks people. It's not that much different now, except that we're ultimately selling a lot fewer individual comic books to people. Bringing back Chris Claremont and John Byrne and making all the heroes white dudes again isn't necessarily going to fix that. And anyway, these kind of projects aren't necessarily needed anymore, because I've seen a lot of these older artists that work conventions. It's probably hard for them to travel. I don't envy them that. It's expensive to travel too, I'm sure. But I'm seeing, you know, before he passed, I remember Alan Bellman was turning up at conventions. Joe Giella still turns up at conventions. Ramona Fraiden. They just do commissions, and they probably do better doing those commissions for X amount of money to people who dearly love them and want to have a piece of these people while they're still with us than they got from some fucking predator assignment. So it ain't so bad. bad necessarily as you guys make the shit out to be. And I don't think there's some grand conspiracy to try to destroy the direct market. The direct market's always been really good about doing that themselves. They're very capable of that. Predator Primal was a 2-issue limited series released with July through August 1997 cover dates, written by Kevin J. Anderson, penciled by Scott Collins, inked by John Lowe. Publisher Summer reads, take one remote Alaskan wilderness, add a lone forest ranger, a crazed grizzly, and an unexpected visitor from the stars. Mix well and you've got a recipe for action. Throw in a forest fire and you've got Predator Primal, the most exciting Predator series to date. An angry grizzly, a raging forest fire, a bloodthirsty predator, and a forest ranger who's feeling way out of her league. Obviously, the last sentences were from the second issue summary, which basically just reiterates what was already in the first issue summary. There's not a lot here. Predator comes down to the Alaskan wilderness during an unseasonably hot period, or it's summer in Alaska and people don't realize Alaska can get hot. It's not just ice all the time, I guess. And he's decided he's going to hunt for bears, but then something goes wrong and it starts a forest fire. And for the most part, the forest fire is used to prevent the forest ranger who's investigating the death of some bear cubs caused by the predator from getting rescued very quickly. But it doesn't really matter because she doesn't have a lot of impact on the story. Ultimately, it comes down to the predator fighting the bear and losing, and then deciding to blow up his ship and a part of the Alaska wilderness. But the mama bear and the baby bears are okay at the end of that. There's also a funny moment where the bear gets the predator in a bear hug and then cracks its back like something out of Nightfall. It doesn't help that it's drawn by Scott Collins, and he's drawing in a style reminiscent of his work in The Flash with Geoff Johns. And this is one of the reasons why this is an Aliens podcast rather than a Predator podcast. Predator stories are stupid. It's just like they're really fucking basic and they're really repetitive, and it doesn't take long to describe them, and they don't require analysis because there is no subtext. Predator fights a bear. That's the fucking story. Next. Dark Horse Presents Volume 1, number 124, cover dated August 1997, hosted the Predator story Bump in the Night by Men of Action, Duncan Rouleau, plotted and drew the art, and written by Steven Siegel. I know I had a discussion with Billy at some point involving discussion of Duncan Rouleau. I don't know where that recording is at the moment, and I want to knock this one out and probably be a long tangent anyway, so we just won't deal with that. It is funny because he, if I recall correctly, was a fan of Rouleau. I am not a fan of that type of exaggerated artwork. I was just running down Gene Colan, but one thing that I was recognizing was that Colan had a very cinematic style, and for the most part, you know, realistic proportions, and you know, you have a sense of place. At that point, he wasn't doing a ton of backgrounds, but it still looked like real people in real circumstances, and I like that kind of artwork, especially for something like Predator where you need a grounding element. Rouleau's much bigger and cartoonier, and you know, I'm an old Bronze Age person. I kind of like my stuff tighter than this, but I can see the appeal of it. It just doesn't necessarily appeal to me. Let me just go ahead and give you the publisher summary. Three suburban boys camping out in one of their backyards share scary stories in the night. One of them says he's seen a monster in a spaceship nearby. The others don't believe him. The boys go to investigate, get a glimpse of a predator target practicing on birds. They escape narrowly, avoiding its notice, but the predator follows them back home, ends on a cliffhanger. I don't believe that's the publisher summary. I think that that must be what somebody at Xenopedia decided to do. They put the fan summary where the publisher summary should be. I don't care. That tells you the story. I didn't find it particularly interesting. I think the main thing, it would have been fun to debate whether or not the predator actually killed the kids or the kids were beneath notice, but the fact the predator bothered to track them back to their tent kind of makes me think he probably killed a lot of them.
And just a final thought, you could probably complain that Predator comics are too much the same, but I don't know how much more you can do with them than they've done. I'm very keen. I recently read the Predator Captive one shot, and that's excellent, but it's basically like Aliens Labyrinth done in a one shot with the Predator. Scientist captures Predator, experiments, goes a bit mad, sets him loose on his own people. That's about all I want. So yeah, lovely.
Predator Captive was a one-shot with a cover date of May 1998. Since we're mostly covering the material chronologically on this podcast, the plan was for Captive to be addressed in the next Predator omnibus, but since Billy brought it up and it's just a one-shot, I figured I'd go ahead and read it real quick for context. It's a brisk read. It's not substantial enough to go back to later on, so let's go ahead and do it now. Written by Gordon Rennie, he's going to do another project that will be covered in the Predator omnibus. Number 3, so we won't bother with him. Same goes for Dean Ormstrom. He's going to do The Hell Comes a-Walking. So basically, instead of doing Captive as a coda to their work, we're going to do it as a prelude to it. And as Billy mentioned, it's basically they managed to capture Predator. It's a one-armed Predator, and the arm with the bomb device on the wrist gauntlet is severed, and they are actually holding it in a tube. I should also mention that there's a little Easter egg in the story where you see a couple of facehuggers in a tube. So this is sort of kind of an Aliens versus Predator story, but not really. And so, like they said, you've got a mad scientist who's wanting to study the predator in captivity and is essentially feeding the predator or human beings to help it to thrive, essentially, so to satisfy the need to the hunt. But this predator has been in captivity for a little while, and it's getting a little bit lethargic. They were thinking that maybe he was weakening in his ability to pursue prey, but actually what it was, he was sort of getting bored and playing around with the prey to make it last a little bit longer just for entertainment purposes. The mad scientist has brought in a new head of security who has facial scars, who had run into a predator back in 1984, and he's basically saying, look, I'm looking at the data here. This predator isn't being studied by you. This predator is studying you. It's already figured out how to get out. The data doesn't lie. We should just shut this whole thing down. If not, you should prepare for the consequences. Sure enough, the predator at one point manages to fake its own death. A team goes in to try to assist the predator, to revive the predator. The head of security is like, you're walking into a trap. This is going to be fucked. Doesn't listen. Sure enough, the predator kills all those guys. The head of security has been implanted into that facility. He's working with the government, seemingly, and he's essentially there to find out what they're doing and to report back to his superiors. The superiors have sent people in to come blow this place up. The mad scientist guy doesn't like that. He smashes the case with the predator's arm over the security guy's head. He probably could have been a little bit better security, or maybe he just took for granted this guy wasn't going to be a problem for him. So he gets his head bashed in. Another guy gets shot by the doctor. The doctor goes in thinking that he's going to calm the predator by giving it its arms back as a sort of a trophy, thinking that's going to in some way appease it and give him an opportunity to make some kind of communication with the predator. The predator once again beats the hell out of him, toys with him, kills him, and then he detonates the gauntlet, which not only takes out the entire base, but also takes out the military company that was coming in to recapture or exterminate him. So Predator wins the round. I'm fine with Dean Normstrom. It's not necessarily my kind of art style, but it was fine for the story, just like it was fine on Black Hammer. I'm not going to be writing home extolling his virtues or anything, but it's okay. As a one-shot, it's fine, but like Billy says, we've been here, we've done this. That's why I can treat it as a throwaway right now. Oh, hey, it had a cover by Dean Williams. It's painted. It's a nice enough rendition of a Predator. It's nothing you haven't seen before. It kind of has a Dave Dormany quality to it. Anti-wife equation, cinema enemy number one. Artificial twins, BSG, billet spy vinyl. Billy Hines, comics enabler, who added, this one's got me on it again. We recorded 5 hours. Crazy. This isn't 5 hours long, though. Talking both Superman aliens crossovers. Such great Jurgens art, wink, because no one demanded it. Meglia update, Elektra 19 and 20 with Greg Rucka. Superman Tarzan number 1 through 3 with Chuck Dixon. Superman number 603 through 605 with Joe Casey. Superman Infinite City graphic novel with Mike Kennedy, who also joined him for Star Wars Underworld number 1 through 6. Wildcats Volume 2 number 5 with Scott Lobdell, who also joined him for Monster World number 1 through 4. CH, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris Dunford, Chris William, D. Kilroy, Derek William Crabb of History of Comics on Film, Dr. Ange, Dirk Ashton, Ed Moore, Iowa's Joe Is, Jen Taylor, Jenny Peterson, Jenny Ramirez, Jeremy Webb, Julio Raul, Keith G. Baker, Lamar the Revenger, Lorenzo Sleece, Mark Gray, Maxo, Miguel Quiroz, No Pop, Once Upon a Geek, Randy Caldwell, Richard Field, September Rains, Speaker of the House Kirk Spencer, Superbound, Talk Nerdy to Me, Nucky 777, Tanya Hodges, and Thirsty's New and Used.
This has been the Raw Old Spine Podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
Coming in January, Dark Horse presents Aliens vs. Batman with guest Captain Entropy.